Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back. I hope you had a wonderful break.
Yeah.
Wonderful camp meeting. Start this week off right. I'm going to announce a test. At least it's announced this time, right? Okay, the test is going to be over chapters 1 through 10, which we haven't quite completed yet, but we will finish probably by tomorrow. The test could have been either next Tuesday or next Friday, so I opted for next Friday, just for your sakes. So Friday, March 7th, we'll be having a test, Jeremiah chapters 1 through 10. It'll include the introductory material in Jeremiah. And it's a relatively short test. March 7th. So, first test.
Is this one that you've prepared, or is it?
No, it's one that's been established test. But it'll be just what has been taught. Nothing more, nothing less, hopefully. If I've done my job and you've done your job, everybody gets an A+, right? And I'm sure I did mine, so we'll leave it at that anyway. All right, we left off in Jeremiah chapter 8, verse 19. Verse 18, he says, "When I would comfort myself against sorrow, my heart is faint in me. Behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people, because of them that dwell in a far country. Is not the Lord in Zion? Is not her king in her? Why have they provoked me to anger with their graven images and with strange vanities?" Now Jeremiah is the one who's speaking in verse 18, but we hear basically God speaking in verse 19. Although when he speaks and Jeremiah speaks in verse 18, he's speaking of him. It's not only his heart, but he's expressing the heart of the Lord here about the sorrow in his heart. "But behold, the voice of the cry of the daughter of my people." The NAS has it, "Behold, listen, the cry of the daughter of my people from a distant land." It's not from them that dwell in a far country exactly, it's from a distant land. In other words, they're crying out from a distant land, the daughter of Zion. Jeremiah is seeing into the future and hearing the cries of the captive is what's happening here. It's a picture that he has of them crying out from their captivity. And they're crying out, "Is not the Lord in Zion?" This is their question. They're crying out, "Why are we in this state that we're in? Isn't God with his people?" The answer is yes, he is with his people. He is in Zion. Unfortunately, they weren't really Zion. He is in Zion, but he's in spiritual Zion. Psalm chapter 132, verses 13 and 14. "For the Lord hath chosen Zion. He hath desired it for his habitation. This is my rest forever. Here will I dwell, for I have desired it." That's he is in Zion. The question they're asking is they're thinking themselves to be Zion just because they're the people of the Lord and they lived in Zion. They lived on Mount Zion. They worshiped there. They called themselves the daughter of Zion. But they weren't really, because spiritually they weren't Zion. Verse 20. "The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved." Here they're crying out still. The harvest is past. This is representing the times of the Gentiles, ending with the rapture. The summer is ended. That is, the tribulation is over. We see this picture elsewhere in Scripture. That the harvest time represents the ingathering of the saints. In the summer, which in Palestine was a very hot time, very hot winds. They didn't grow crops then. It was very dry and very hot. And it represents the tribulation. And it's over. And we're not saved. See, the Jews are still unregenerate at that point. Even after the tribulation, they're unregenerate. And it's not until the tribulation upon the world, and at the end of that, when Christ comes again, then they're saved. But not until then. And what God is doing in his last day, because of the hardness of the heart of his people, He is using the Antichrist in the last days to drive the Jews to him. This is why they will cry between the porch and the altar, because they're in tremendous distress. And at that point in time, they'll be totally broken and totally humiliated, and they'll have nothing left but to cry out to God. And then when he reveals himself for who he is, and they shall look upon him whom they pierced, and they shall mourn as one mourneth for his only begotten son. That's in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10. Then they'll be ready to receive. Then they'll be ready. But they're not saved up to that point. Verse 21. For the hurt of the daughter of my people am I hurt. I am black. Astonishment hath taken hold on me. Now this is Jeremiah mourning. This black has the idea of his countenance being filled with grief. Blackness upon him. It's just a grief. You might parallel 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 26 here, where it speaks of those mourning. We are to be mourning with those who mourn. And this is Jeremiah's heart. He is identifying with his people, and they're in the midst of mourning because of the great distress upon them. It's also a type of Christ who became black with sin for us. You might compare 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21. He who knew no sin became sin for us. See, he took the sin upon himself for us, bore the grief of it. And this is Jeremiah identifying with his people, mourning for them. And so Christ mourned for the sin of his people also, and bore it upon himself. And it says, I am black, astonishment hath taken hold of me. This astonishment, Rotherham has horror. And this may represent, in a sense, what Christ experienced on the cross. It also represents what he experienced in recognizing what he would have to go through for his Father and for to do what his Father wanted to be done. Mark chapter 14, verses 33 and 34. When the revelation of what God was requiring of him really struck home, and as it were, God withdrew the revelation of his end result, it was very hard, a very difficult thing, and astonishment came over Christ. Mark chapter 14, verses 33 and 34. And he taketh with him Peter, James, and John. This is when he went into Gethsemane. And began to be sore amazed, and to be very heavy. And saith unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here and watch. See, at this point, what God was requiring of him was upon him. He was going to have to separate himself forever from his Father. He had to be willing to do that. And that word amazed, that's just what it means. He was sore amazed. It was amazing to him what he would have to do. It was astounding. It was overwhelming. And this is when the grief began to come upon him. And ultimately, in Mark chapter 15, verse 34, and at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is being interpreted, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? See, at that point, the blackness overcame him, the mourning, the heaviness overcame him. And so it's a type of Christ in this picture here. The hurt of the daughter of my people, I am hurt. And that's how Christ was hurt, for the hurt of the daughter of his people. He bore the sins of his people. Verse 22, Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered? Now, Gilead is an area east of Jordan, and the balm in Gilead was used medicinally for physical wounds. But neither this balm nor any physician would be of any help to Judah. I compare chapter 46, verse 11 here. See, their wound is incurable at this point. Go up into Gilead and take balm, O virgin, the daughter of Egypt. In vain shalt thou use many medicines, for thou shalt not be cured. Now here it's speaking of Egypt. But this is the same thing. They won't be healed. There's a balm in Gilead for healing, and they may go for it, and they may apply it. But this kind of balm will not work. See, what happened with Judah was they persisted in rejecting Yahweh Rapha. You remember that's his covenant name. We see that in Exodus chapter 15, verse 26. That he is the healer. And if they look upon him, they shall be healed. He is really the balm of Gilead. But because they were rejecting him, there could be no recovery. There would be no spiritual health to them because of that. See, when you reject part of the covenant, you reject God. And ultimately, you reject all of the covenant. It becomes of none effect to you. Chapter 9. Oh, that my head were waters and mine eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. Now in the Hebrew Bible, this is verse 23 of chapter 8. And chapter 9 actually begins with verse 2 here. And you see it fits. My head were waters. Oh, that my head were waters and mine eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep. This is God's love shown in and through Jeremiah's tears. That's why he's called the weeping prophet. Weeping for the people of God. Crying for their pain and their suffering. Crying for their sin. Crying for their unrepentance. Crying for their unwillingness. When we see that Christ wept, it was because of unbelief. When he came to the tomb of Lazarus, it says Jesus wept. He knew he was going to raise Lazarus. He knew before Lazarus died that he was going to allow Lazarus to die, that he would lay in the tomb 4 days, and that he would raise him for the glory of God. He knew that in advance. And so when he came, he didn't weep over Lazarus. He wept at their unbelief. That's what Jeremiah is weeping at, unbelief. That apatheia. It's the same thing that caused him to fall in the wilderness. That's the most horrible thing, unbelief. Because it's totally destructive. Totally destructive. It denies God himself and his power, his nature, his ability to perform his will. It denies the word of God, denies the power of God. Unbelief is really a horrid thing. And the fact of the matter is that the majority of Christians have, to one degree or another, unbelief in their lives. And in most of Christendom, it's rampant. It's rampant. Unbelief. Walking around, not knowing the scriptures nor the power of God. Really not knowing it because they live in unbelief. Practicing atheist, as it were. Believing in God, that he is a God and that they are saved, but all the promises to them are nay. You know, they're not true. They don't believe them. They even preach it from their pulpits. Well, healing is not for today. We'll pray God that he would heal you, but if you don't get healed, it's his will that you be sick. That's not what my Bible says. Unbelief, it penetrates every bit of Christendom. It does. Even in our own church, we find this. Go over to the healing lines. A lot of people get healed. They really do. And God moves. But if you talk to the healing ministers, you will find that unbelief is just, that's the biggest foe. It's the biggest foe. They can rebuke demons, and the demons will flee. They can command the work of God's hand, and people will be healed. But the people won't believe. Those healing lines, I mean, take for example, last Friday, when Danny asked those that had these afflictions to come down front, and it filled the whole front of the church. And that was just with basically lung ailments, colds, coughs, congestion, walking pneumonia, long-standing things. And it filled the front. I don't know how many were there, a couple hundred, easily. Now, you don't see that many in the healing line every time. Why? It's unbelief. It really is. Hopelessness, despair. You know, it's also this thing of, well, it's just a little cough. I don't need to pray about it. You think God isn't concerned? See, that's an area of unbelief. It says, well, God is only concerned if it's really serious. See? But that's not true. That's not true. He's not, you know, I mean, in one sense, he may say, son, I want you to, or daughter, I want you to learn by this situation. Yes, he may do that. But one of the things he may be asking you to learn is to go stand in the healing line. That's the truth. Where I used to work, I get people coming in, and And I'd talk to them, and they'd say, "Say, how you doing?" "Well, I've been sick all week long." "Oh, really? I'm sorry." You know, and I was working, and I wasn't free to pray for them right there. You know, they're standing in my line. I used to work at a grocery store. And, you know, I just not ready to reach over, you know, while everybody else is waiting, lay hands on and pray for them. But so I'd say, "Have you gone through the healing line?" "Well, no. It's middle of the week, and you know." "Oh, did you call a healing minister? They'll come over to your house and pray for you." "Well, no. I haven't called a healing minister." "Really? Well, you know that's what they're there for. Why don't you call them?" "Yeah, I probably ought to do that." I mean, I found almost nobody who had called. Almost nobody, and this is over years and years. Unbelief. I don't want to bother them. That's what their heart is. They want to pray for you for healing. Oh, it's only a little thing. You know, it denies the nature of God. It does. It denies the nature of God. It's amazing. It's amazing. We, martyrdom complexes and all kinds of things that go along with that. You know, well, I'll just suffer through. Well, if God doesn't want you to suffer through, why suffer through? Bearing my cross, you know, picking it up daily and bearing my cross. You know, if that's not the cross that he asked you to bear, then why bear it? It's like the testimony that sister gave last night. She found out that she was carrying her son and daughter in her pack, and that's why it was so heavy burden on her. Because she was never asked to carry that burden. You got to keep coming to him. It's amazing. It's amazing what happens. And we see here, speaking of day and night, weeping day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. So it represents Christ, whoever liveth, to make intercession for us, as it were weeping before the Lord. Now, in reality, just his presence and the work that he's done, that is our intercession, and it stands forever. But it's a type of Christ who is ever present there to intercede for us. This word slain here, the slain of my people, the daughter of my people, means to be pierced or wounded. It also means to be profaned or polluted, as by prostitution. Speaking of them and their idolatry, and he's weeping over that. He's weeping over their sin. He's weeping how they've been wounded. It also means to become common. That is, they were to be a peculiar treasure unto God. And they've made themselves common. Profane. That's what profane means, really. It means to be common. Vulgar. That's what the word vulgar means, too. It means to be common. And see, we're to be a peculiar people. We're not to be common or vulgar or profane, but a peculiar treasure unto God. And that's what he wants. And there is weeping, as it were, in heaven over the state of his people, because they've made themselves common. Verse 2. Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place of wayfaring men, that I might leave my people and go from them. For they be all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men. The wickedness was so deep that escape to a wilderness refuge seemed preferable to the degradations of Jerusalem. This is Jeremiah speaking. He doesn't want to see what's going to happen to them. He wanted to be free from the sights that would thrust themselves upon him day by day as he walked through his people, seeing the sin in their lives and knowing the judgment that would come to them. It's as though he wants to remove himself from them. And in a sense, it's a good place to be. See, we don't want to live in that place. We don't want to live in Sodom. We don't want to view those things and have our focus on them. He had to see the way they were living, and he had to preach against it, but he had to also find a place in God, a lodging place in God, in the Spirit. And it's a place in God where our strength can be renewed. Psalm chapter 55, verses 6 and 7. We're going to go forth in these last days, and we're going to be proclaiming the good news of the gospel, but we're also going to be proclaiming the judgment of God upon the people, and we're going to be out there walking in a church that is overcome by sin, given over to spiritual prostitution, And the heathen, the unsaved out there, who are literally given over to prostitution and every other imaginable evil and things that are not even imagined. And we're going to have to find a resting place in God, a real, safe resting place in God. Otherwise, it will be such grief to our souls. I mean, we'll be overcome by it. There's got to be a peace. See, Jesus was at times overcome by the sin of his people, overcome by the problems of his people, but he had a resting place in God. He had to. He had to. I experienced some of this myself recently in just some things that are happening with certain people that I love dearly, that are in deep trouble. And the weight of it begins to really weigh on you because the pain of it, the pain of what is happening, and the pain of separation that is taking place in the body of Christ right now. But there's, and it was heavy on me yesterday, and I just had to come to service last night early and just go up and dance before the Lord and just worship Him alone and just lock into Him and love Him. Because otherwise the burden is too heavy. You know, and the burden of the Lord is not to be too heavy, but it's a painful thing. And I know this is for the future. This is going to happen. We're going to be in that same place. And we need to find that place of refuge in Him and comfort and strength in Him. For treacherous men, Kyle reads, faithless men, faithless ones. Did I read Psalm 55, verses 6 to 7? I was going to. Was it 6 and 7? And I said, "Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then would I fly away and be at rest. Lo, then would I wander far off and remain in the wilderness." Now, this is not a bad wilderness here. This is a wilderness away from the sin of this world, apart from the evil of this world. When I have those wings of a dove, born by the Spirit of God into a place of rest in Him, hidden in the cleft of the rock. Verse 3. And they bend their tongues like their bow for lies, but they are not valiant for the truth upon the earth. For they proceed from evil to evil, and they know not me, saith the Lord. Rotherham, for this verse, has, "Who have prepared their tongue as their bow of falsehood, and not by faithfulness have they become mighty in the land. For from wickedness unto wickedness have they gone forth, but me have they not known, declareth Yahweh." Rather than knowing the true one and knowing the truth, they have chosen wickedness and falsehood and lies and deceit. In Psalm, you might write for this, Psalms 57 verse 4, 58 verse 7. Psalms 57:4 and 58 verse 7, and Psalm 64 verses 3 through 7. Speaking of the iniquity, it says, "Who whet their tongue like a sword, and bend their bows to shoot their arrows, even bitter words, that they may shoot in secret at the perfect. Suddenly do they shoot at him and fear not. They encourage themselves in an evil matter. They commune of laying snares privily. They say, who shall see them? But God shall shoot at them with an arrow. Suddenly shall they be wounded." See, that the wicked are out there to destroy because they're of their father, the devil. They're out to destroy the perfect, those that are upright in heart. Those are just. Those that love God. They want to destroy them. They're seeking them. Excuse me. Tissues. And they know not God. And this reminds me of in Romans, because they retain not God in their knowledge, He's given them over to a reprobate mind. They proceed from evil to evil because they would not know Him. They have no desire to know God, and therefore they just go their wicked way and do whatever they want to do.
Interesting how we're to go for glory.
Yeah, that's right. Glory to glory versus evil to evil, and that really is the truth. Those are the two options. The world doesn't see it that way. To them, we come preaching a gospel that is the savor of death unto death. But to them that believe, it's life unto life. It's glory to glory for us. Because it's death to self and alive unto Christ and alive unto God. But to them, what they see as life is going from wickedness to wickedness, from evil to evil, from sin to sin. Verse 4. Take ye heed, every one of ye, one of his neighbor, and trust ye not in any brother, for every brother will utterly supplant, and every neighbor will walk with slanders. Trust ye not in any brother. That is, even the intimacy of kinship and friendship is shamefully abused. And this Jesus said would happen in the last days. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 36, it says, a man's foes shall be them of his own household. That's who his foes will be. Isn't that who's attacking the church most? Brethren. That's what it says in Isaiah 66. Your brethren shall cast you out. Say, let the Lord be glorified. But he's going to come to their shame and our joy if we will walk with him. In chapter 12, verse 6, we see that Jeremiah's own family turned against him. Now, that's a hard thing. You'd think, hopefully, that someone would stand with him. But all he had was Barak, his scribe. There was none else. You don't see in Jeremiah God saying, I have 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal, hidden away in caves. You don't see that. That's the way it was in the time of Elijah. Elijah was sure that there was none that were walking with God but himself. But God said, don't despair. I have 7,000 who have not bowed the knee. But you don't see that here. He had nobody. Even his own family turned against him. Now, there were those who were perhaps what we might call sometime disobedient. In other words, they listened, they heard, but they still wouldn't walk. I mean, we saw before that there was silver. There was something worth redeeming in Judah. But it was so filled with dross that it was impossible to separate it. And so the judgment that was coming upon them to go to Babylon was the thing that was going to separate that out and to find those ones. Because when Jeremiah came preaching, they wouldn't turn. But when judgment came, then they were ready. Now this word supplant in here, it says, every brother will utterly supplant. In the Hebrew, it's a play on words. And it alludes to Jacob's deceit that we see in Genesis 27, verse 36. Literally, it's Akov Yaakov. And it's the same root for Jacob, Yaakov. It means supplanting, he will supplant. Jacobing, he will Jacob. Pointing to their lower nature, who they really are. They really are Jacob, fully. And they're not Israel that they thought they were. Verse 5. And they will deceive everyone his neighbor and will not speak the truth. They have taught their tongue to speak lies and weary themselves to commit iniquity. They have taught their tongues. It shows a premeditation and much practice. They're working diligently at lying. And they weary themselves to commit iniquity. They work hard at it. They labor to commit iniquity. Not only that, but sin wearies the soul. And they're being wearied by it. But they don't even see it. There's no rest to the wicked. There is no rest. They're like Satan, walking to and fro about the earth, restless. No peace, no rest. This is a thing that we have in God that is the most blessed thing. Is the peace of God that passes understanding. That is such a blessing. That's such a witnessing tool. Friend, I don't know what you've got, but I'll tell you this. There is such peace. When I go home and I go to sleep at night, I sleep. And I feel good. And I'm not in turmoil. I'm not worried. I'm not frustrated. I just have peace. And people, you know, if they can see that in your life, they'll look at you and say, you've got something. You've got something I want. They'll see the love too, and they want that too. And they go hand in hand together. But there's no peace to the wicked. There's no rest. None at all. Verse 6. Thine habitation is in the midst of deceit. Through deceit they refuse to know me, saith the Lord. They live in deceit. That's where they dwell. But here he's speaking particularly, thine habitation, this is Jeremiah, your habitation is in the midst of deceit. He was as Lot in Sodom, whose righteous soul was vexed day by day. You see that in Hebrews, I think it is. It's through deceit that they refuse to know him. See, they want the deceit. They want to be deceived. They're unwilling to walk with God, and deception comes. Through the deceitfulness of sin, there's a full deception that begins to come upon a person that's produced by sin. And it's a progressive thing. And it's a horrible thing. Deception is a horrible thing. And it's progressive. And it starts with a little deception. That's where it begins. A little sin, a little area where we begin to say no when God begins to deal. A little hardening of the heart. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. And then deceit. Then deception comes. The sin deceives us. And it builds bit by bit. It's why we have to be in a place of tenderness before the Lord. Always. Always. It is so important. I had a brother ask me regarding a really difficult situation. Somebody who told him he was unwilling to do what God wanted him to do. And it just broke him up. It absolutely shattered him. He came to me and he said, is that what it really is? Is it really boiled down to unwillingness? Is it that simple? And I said, yes. It says in Thessalonians, because they received not the love of the truth, therefore I will send them strong delusion that they should believe a lie and be damned. Unwillingness. If any man be willing to do the will of my Father, he will know of the doctrine, whether it be of me or man or be of God. If any man be willing. We have got to be willing. I mean, God knows our hearts so that sometimes we're in a state of unwillingness because of difficulties, problems, wrong concepts, etc. And God knows that. But some of what is happening with people now is they are in open unwillingness. And this is what broke this brother up. He spoke to him, to this person, and the person knows the truth, knows it, spoke it in front of him, and admitted, I'm not willing to do the will of God. I'm not willing to follow the word of God. He said that literally, word for word. I'm choosing my will over the will of God. And that absolutely destroyed him. As he said, is it really that simple? And it really is. That is the most dangerous position one can ever find themselves in. Absolutely the most dangerous. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 13. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. We need to be watching for one another. If any of us see a brother taken in a fault, ye which are spiritual. We need to be in a place of being spiritual, humble and broken, and going and exhorting. Not saying, look, brother, you got this problem in your life, you better get it taken care of, but going and weeping over them, saying, brother, please, don't you see? Can't you see? Exhorting in that fashion, covering one another, being our brother's keeper. We need to do that, lest we be hardened also. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 22 also. That you put off concerning the former conversation the old man which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. These are the lusts of deceit. Deceitful lusts. They deceive. The lusts of the flesh deceive. Because we give into them in the sin and it deceives. Also in Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can know it? It's why we need to be renewed by the Lord, and we need to be broken and contrite before Him. Because if we're living by our own mind, if we're living by our own, you know, at the time of the judges it said that every man did what was right in his own eyes. And that's why the Philistines came in. Because what was right in his own eyes was not right before God. And it's very deceitful. The heart, it's amazing the things we justify. It is. We justify them. We don't think about it at the time, but we justify them. And God comes and convicts us later. Oh my. And it's demons, but it's also the carnal nature. The carnal nature. Verse 7. Therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, I will melt them and try them, for how shall I do for the daughter of my people? Now this is the same imagery as we saw in chapter 6, verses 28 through 30. The furnace, trying to melt them and try them, to find silver in them, to redeem them. He's looking for that pure silver. And this last phrase says, for how shall I do for the daughter of my people? Literally, or a better reading perhaps, as Aeneas has it, what else can I do for my people? It's as though a plaintive cry from God. What else can I do? God is going to bring judgment and is bringing judgment on people because of their sin and their unwillingness. And it's as though God is saying, what else can I do? I've given them everything else. I've given them truth. I've given them the Word. I've given them counselors. I've spoken to them time after time, year after year. And now I have to bring judgment. What else can I do? It's His heart of love. I've tried everything. What else can I do? This passage really impacts me when I've thought about this. It's perhaps one of the things that when I took Jeremiah stood out from the whole class. His heart of love toward his people. How much he loves his people. It's not that he wants to bring suffering or judgment or pain upon his people, but what else can he do? Verse 8, their tongue is as an arrow shot out. It speaketh deceit. One speaketh peaceably to his neighbor with his mouth, but in heart he layeth his weight. Arrow shot out is literally a piercing or a murdering arrow. Their tongue is this way. It's a murdering arrow. Isn't that what James says? Tongue is set on fire of hell, a world of iniquity. Speaking peace with the mouth, but in the heart. Inwardly, Aeneas has it, but inwardly he sets an ambush for him. Psalm 55, verse 21. The words of his mouth were smoother than butter, but war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet were they drawn swords. So this is them lying in wait to deceive. Waiting to deceive. Smooth words to deceive and catch the people in the snare. This is the heart of the people at this time in Judah. This is why God is going to judge them. Verse 9, shall I not visit them for these things, saith the Lord? Shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Verse 10, for the mountains will I take up a weeping and a wailing, for the habitations of the wilderness a lamentation, because they are burned up, so that none can pass through them, neither can men hear the voice of the cattle. Both the fowl of the heavens and the beasts are fled, they are gone. This habitations of the wilderness is pastures. And so it's speaking of the pastures of the wilderness, speaking of all things being burnt up. Jeremiah is lamenting the widespread devastation and destruction of life and property that is about to befall the land. He's seeing it as though it's done. The mountains and the pastures on which the beast graze will be ravaged. I might compare Joel chapter 2, verse 3 here. God is going to visit such a nation as this. Verse 11, "And I will make Jerusalem heaps and a den of dragons, and I will make the cities of Judah desolate without an inhabitant." This heaps is speaking of heaps of ruins, utter destruction to Jerusalem, and the dragons are jackals. And jackals inhabit the waste places like that. Verse 12, "Who is the wise man that may understand this? And who is he whom the mouth of the Lord hath spoken, that he may declare it? For what the land perisheth and is burned up like a wilderness that none passes through." Now, who is it that will know this and understand it? Well, Christ understood it. He understood this. That which God spoke, he understood it. He understood the heart of God for his people. The man-child will understand it also. They'll understand why the land was ruined. See, these things are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the earth are come. And we're to understand these things and see and take heed to what God has written that we might learn and we might turn to him. This last phrase here. Not the last phrase, excuse me. For what the land perisheth and is burned up like a wilderness, or I guess the whole phrase, that none passes through. The NAS has it, "Why is the land ruined, laid waste like a desert, so that no one passes through?" In other words, this is what they will know. It's asking this question, and they'll be able to answer this question. Why is it laid waste? Verse 13, "And the Lord saith, because they have forsaken my law which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, neither walked therein." And this is the answer. This is why the land is laid waste. It's a very simple thing. They have forsaken my law which I set before them, and have not obeyed my voice, and neither walked therein. And this is what they said earlier, wasn't it? We will not walk therein. We will not walk in your ways. They rejected both the written and the spoken word. They forsook the law, they disobeyed his voice, and they wouldn't walk. Therefore, the destruction comes upon them. Verse 14, "But they have walked after the imagination of their own heart, and after Balaam, which their fathers taught them." This word Balaam is just the plural of Baal. It means Baals, or many lords. And this is what led them to total confusion. Their feelings, lusts, idols, emotions, pride, demonic lies, sins, carnal appetites, wrong concepts. That's the Balaam that exists in us today. They had the Balaam, the Ashtaroth, that they fell down to and on every high hill to worship. And every idol, every demonic activity to be involved in worshiping false deities. But today, we're seeing it in a little different vein. You know, you don't see the idols on every corner. You know, the people. You know, you can in the East. You've got your little shrines all over the place. You can in Italy, too. Little shrines that you can put your money in or light a candle to, or but for the most part it's inward things now that are the idols. And that's really all it was before. It was where their heart was. After the imagination of their heart, see? That's what he said. And so what are the Balaam of our lives? This is what we need to watch for. What do we put up? What do we exalt over God? What do we allow demons to exalt over God? That's why we need to be casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalted itself against the knowledge of God. The warfare is in the mind, and that's the things that we need to cast down. Lest they become, as it were, idols to us, and we be worshiping them without even realizing it. Without even thinking that that's what we're doing. That's why we need to get our concepts cleared up. And live by that which comes out of His mouth. And not out of our own mind and out of demons' minds. Now the fathers taught them this. It's the traditions of the fathers. You might compare here Galatians chapter 1, verse 14. Galatians 1:14, Colossians 2:8, and 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18. All of those verses speak of the traditions of the fathers, vain traditions. And those traditions include our concepts and our thinking. Secular humanism. Women's lib that we've been taught, things like that. Those concepts, we don't realize how powerful they are. They are very powerful. Very powerful. Because we think that they're us, and we think that they're right. And that's the problem. That's the problem. Every man thinks in his own mind that what he thinks is what everybody else thinks, basically. And that what he thinks is right. Now, we admit that, well, maybe we're wrong on some points, but basically, we don't know where we're wrong. That's what deception is. You don't know how you're deceived. You can't see it. We've got to be in a place of real tenderness before the Lord to let Him deal with those things. All those things that we thought were us and we think for sure are right. Those things can block deliverances because the demons have us so buffaloed into thinking that that's us and that must be what's right. It's true. An example of that in dealing with what is termed a second-rate spirit or, you know, unworthiness, that kind of thing. People accepting, well, I'm just a concubine. I can't be anything more than that. But I'll be happy to be a concubine for You, Lord. That's demonic. The demons can't get you to believe that, you know, to walk away from God totally. So what are they going to do? Keep you from the highest place that He has. Keep you in a place of unbelief. Amazing. We need to throw those things out. Some of those things, I know dealing with one person, went way, way back to childhood, trained that way, but in church too. Trained in church. Not so much, well, you can't be the bride of Christ because they didn't even really have a bride of Christ theology. But the whole concept of just being a servant unto the Lord, and that's all. You're just a servant, you're just nobody, you're humble, and you can't ever, you know, if God ever tried to exalt you, see, I mean, you can't do that. You can't allow that. You can't allow that, see? I mean, because that would bring pride, fear of pride and all those things. I say let God do whatever He wants to do. And cast the pride out. Really. That's right. Let Him do what He wants to do. Verse 15. Therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will feed them, even this people, with wormwood and give them water of gall to drink. Now this wormwood is a bitter, poisonous plant, and it shows the bitterness of their judgment. And the water of gall is poisoned water. We saw this also in chapter 8, verse 14. Verse 16, I will scatter them also among the heathen, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, and I will send a sword after them till I have consumed them. This sword represents judgment that will follow them even when they're dispersed, because they will continue in sin. It also shows the severity of their present sin. See, a consumption of sin has been decreed by God. It's going to be consumed off the face of this earth. It's going to be consumed out of our lives. He's going to run it out of us. And we have a choice. Either get rid of it, or live in the habitation of demons the rest of our lives. Or have the habitation of demons be us for the rest of our lives.
So this sword, you look at the Jews, they've had it tough ever since they were dispersed.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of that sword.
That's right. Well, from the time that they went into Judah, really, in a sense, almost from their inception. After Solomon, things went downhill. And the sword basically chased him from that time on. It did. Assyria, you know, the Philistines. Just, they were under continual barrage because they weren't walking with God. They went into, you know, Israel goes into captivity in Assyria. Judah goes into captivity in Babylon. And when they come out, they're still under the control and authority of somebody else. And then the Greeks come in. And then the Romans come in. And then they're totally dispersed after that. And like you say, the sword has been following them ever since. They're persecuted. They've been persecuted in every land they've ever gone to. Every land. Killed, persecuted, ostracized, kept apart from the rest of society. Now, part of it they did themselves. They didn't want to mix, you know. They were stiff-necked and they wouldn't mix. So, you know, that part of it they brought on themselves. But the sword has followed them. Persecution has followed them. It follows them today. I mean, there's no rest to them. There is no rest. God has kept them in that state of agitation, you might say. He promised He would. But the end result is that all Israel shall be saved. And that's a good thing. Verse 17. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider ye and call them for the mourning, and call for the mourning women, that they may come, and send for cunning women, that they may come. This mourning women is, they're hired women, women who are hired for, they're professional mourners, professional criers for funerals. He's saying, call them. It's your funeral. Call some criers. You might compare Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 5, Amos chapter 5, verse 16, and Mark chapter 5, verse 38. And the cunning women represents wise women. And these are the women who skillfully lead the other mourners. These are the ones who possess the real art of raising the emotions to a fever pitch. The best, you know, to get the mourners to bring out the highest amount of mourning. And they work at it. They're the cunning women. They're capable of doing this. And he's saying, call these out. You're going to need a lot of mourners. Verse 18, and let them make haste and take up a wailing for us, that our eyes may run down with tears and our eyelids gush out with waters. For us, that is the living. They're alive. But what it really shows is they're dead in sin. And Jeremiah is identifying with his people. Call out the mourners for us, even though we're alive, because we're dead in trespasses and sins, as we see in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1. Ephesians 2, 1. And we see Jeremiah identifying with his people there. We are dead in trespasses and sin as a people. Verse 19. For a voice of wailing is heard out of Zion. How are we spoiled? We are greatly confounded because we have forsaken the land, because our dwellings have cast us out. They're forced to leave. It's not voluntary. Even though it says forsaken, they're being forced to leave. Now in the NAS it says, because our dwellings have cast us out, it says because they have cast down our dwellings. And the they there would be Babylon. Or you can look at it another way, seeing the way it's in the King James, because our dwellings have cast us out. It's the same thing as the Canaanites. Just like the Canaanites were vomited out of the land because of their sin. They were destroyed because of their sin. They were cast out of the land. Now it was done by killing them. So is Judah is in the same place because of their sin. The land will vomit them out. You're going to cast them out. Verse 20. Yet hear the word of the Lord, O ye women, and let your ear receive the word of His mouth, and teach your daughters wailing, and every one her neighbor lamentation. Now, rather than get into this, we'll start here tomorrow.